This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Eitan Krasilovsky. He's Southwest Region Director of the Forest Guild, and Jan Willem Janssens, Director of Ecotone, Ecological Planning and Restoration. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Hi.
It's great to be here.
And we're here to talk about watershed health and how we go about achieving it, what's in the way of it, what have people done, what are we doing to restore it. Now, when we're talking today, we're talking about a particular watershed from, what is it, Peñasco to Dixon?
That's right. It's the lower Embudo watershed. It's about 70,000 acres of a total watershed of about 180 or 190,000 that starts way up high in the Sangre de Cristos at near Jicarita Peak. But we take the lower part down from Peñasco to the Rio Grande.
And what are the challenges of this particular watershed?
So the watershed has challenges that span the lower and the upper portion. The upper portion has a few communities in it, also Las Trampas, Ojos Arco, El Valle, and the lower portion is dominated by Dixon. And over the past 5 years or so, we've really been digging into this watershed and looking at what are the issues. And also listening to people who live there and what are the issues they experience.
And what are the issues they experience?
A big issue for them is to live with the threat of wildfire. Another issue for them was issues of drought associated with serious erosion and then downstream the problems of sedimentation on roads and in acequias and on their fields. And then thirdly, when arroyos or areas erode, inevitably trash washes up and gets out on the roads and in the fields. And as a result of all those dynamics, native plants really have a difficulty regenerating. And so then you see a lot of weeds coming in along roadsides and in the arroyos and in people's fields. So those are the main issues that came out of community meetings of the last 7 years or so.
And I'd like to add on to that that it was also identified that water quality in the Embudo Creek was being degraded by the erosion. And to expand upon the fire risk that people are living with in the upper watershed, there's also the post-fire risk of flooding and debris flows that affects the communities that live near drainages and also the communities at the lower end of the watershed, like Dixon, that after a large wildfire would have some pretty serious impacts from flooding.
Let's talk for a moment about erosion. What is the cause of erosion that is greater? Like, what is the human-generated cause of erosion that's greater than normal?
In the higher part of that watershed, the upper part, the forested part of the watershed, a large part of the erosion seems to come from roads. A lot of forest roads, driveways, areas disturbed by human use of that area, and then and they're often not properly designed or not properly maintained, to the point that then storms take a lot of topsoil away, run down the arroyos, and then the arroyos start eroding further. Then in the lower watershed, it's a very sensitive area. If people have driven around Dixon and up to Ojos Arco, it is a very characteristic area of, you could almost say, natural rock castles. And it's an old sandstone area that probably after the Ice Age, started to gradually erode in the last 200-300 years with the pressure of removal of firewood, construction wood, overgrazing, mining, and everything that has happened there has very rapidly eroded. And that sand is very soft, and once the top rock layers have been removed in some way, the sandstone just crumbles and disintegrates and is coming down by, well, for just the village of Dixon, we're estimating in the order of hundreds of thousands of tons per year that are coming down.
Oh my goodness.
Series of arroyos there.
Yes. Where does it go?
It goes all in the Embudo River, and the Embudo has about 5 to 10 major flood pulses per year between the spring and the summer, and eventually drops all that water into the Rio Grande, and that flows down to lakes like Cochiti Lake.
And so when you have these human activities, even after you stop doing them, like a mine is finished or a road is built, the damage is done and the process continues.
That's right, especially in years after drought, when you have very poor vegetation and heavy rainstorms come down, some like this year, you get serious runoff of sediment. We also need to remember that a lot of the land there is public land, and its management has is so problematic because there are so many acres and staff of the public agencies are underfunded to maintain it, and people from the communities go out for recreational activities, sometimes with four-wheelers. Sometimes in the past there has been vegetation removal either by the agencies or people, local people, that have denuded entire areas. So these denuded areas are extra susceptible to runoff and erosion.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that that another background source of erosion is that the upper portions that are forested oftentimes don't have an understory layer of grasses and flowering plants. Many of those areas used to have that component that would really hold soil. Right now they have pine needles, and that not having the grasses and flowering plants there is allowing a lot of runoff to happen.
Yeah, that's a good point, Eitan, because basically what I think listeners should or might want to visualize is that a lot of our native landscape had soils that were serving as a sponge. And so that you need to picture that when water and snow falls on that soil, that in the past, say 200-300 years ago, it would infiltrate in a deep organic soil, at least probably several feet. We have lost that over the last several hundred years as a result of grazing, logging, and all kind of activities. And that hasn't really grown back because it grows back very, very slowly. And then with the overgrowth of forests that have not adequately burnt naturally, that have actually overgrown, a lot of the biomass ended up in, and organic matter ended up in the trees and didn't have a chance to develop in the form of undergrowth plants. Even in the open areas with pinon and juniper, we see a lack of grasses in general.
I think that's a really important point is when you talk about fire, people think of fires as being so destructive and they don't think of them as constructive, but fires construct soil. They construct the ground in which things grow. Is that how it works?
So fire is a natural recycler in many of our ecosystems, particularly ponderosa pine and some mixed conifer and some pinon juniper, and in grasslands and in grassy openings. So fire recycles nutrients and it stimulates many grasses to grow, particularly in the right time of year. So we need fire to have healthy grasses and healthy understory species. Forests that have seen fire, particularly low-intensity fire, the kind of good fire we'd like to see, are more biodiverse.
So we've got a big mess on our hands.
That's right. And so
and it's funny because we really do have a big, huge mess on our hands, which is not visible to the naked eye if you don't know what you're looking for. You might walk out in the forest and say, ah, the lovely forest and the birds chirping, but you don't see that there is a really major human hand in what you're looking at.
Exactly. Yeah. And the nice thing of the human hand, keep it positive, is that while we have had a hand, a very strong hand, in the damage that we're actually seeing and that people experience right now, or the threats that people experience from these overgrown forests. On the other hand, we're exploring also ways of how that hand can actually kickstart natural regeneration in certain ways. And regeneration is a technical term for a natural regrowth of vegetation. And vegetation in this landscape is typically what we see above ground, but we forget that half of that vegetation biomass and biology is underground. And one of the things that, for instance, in our work, we're trying to bring to the attention of foresters and the agencies is how important the care for that underground biology is, and the covering of the soil in ways that the underground biology can be stimulated.
Now, part of the underground biology is fed by underground springs. Is that how does it, what is the water, what is the role of water in all of this?
In only certain areas, and we definitely have some of those, even in the driest areas around Dixon, there are definitely springs coming out of those sandstones. But those are areas where, I want to call them the sweet spots, where you can do work and where actually an entire little valley where you can preserve the soil as a sponge plug holds back the degradation, the erosion upstream, because it basically, like a cork, holds back the certain form, you could say the pressure of the gravity on that valley. Because if you have a very steep valley, you could imagine that if you have halfway a little plug, that the soils above it don't slump down as fast. And that also the wetness and the vegetation of that healthy area wicks up, that gradually creeps up the slopes. And we can see that does work that way. And so, but that is where the springs happen. The other part is that when it rains and when snow comes down, that water infiltrates or should infiltrate. And we're trying to find ways to keep vegetation and soil on the ground so that water has a greater chance to infiltrate.
Yeah, and in addition to that, snowpack is a really important source of our water. We want our snow to get onto the ground and to slowly infiltrate. We don't want it to get caught up in tree canopies too much. When we have a closed canopy forest in the southwest, the snow often gets intercepted by the canopy, and it sublimates back into water vapor with our hot sun rather than reaching the forest floor.
So it basically lands on the trees and goes back into the air without ever hitting the floor.
Exactly.
And that's because we've let the trees grow so much because there hasn't been sufficient wildfire. Because of why? Fire suppression, like putting out forest fires all the time?
Exactly. We're really good at putting out fires. It was our national policy for the last 100 years. We've made some great strides in the last just 2 years in the southwest at identifying where managing a wildfire for resource benefit, for the benefit of the forest and the watershed, can happen. San Carlos Apache Reservation has had some of the largest managed wildfires in the last 2 years, and they've done a great job at that.
Another reason is that we don't have the grass cover anymore in both the mosaic of the higher elevation forests and the pinyon juniper savannas that used to have much more grass. And that is a result of overgrazing and other ways of that people have used those areas, to the point that with the grass, also the soil has washed out, because the grass and its mat of roots holds back the soil really well. And 200 years of poorly managed grazing has done away with a lot of the grasses that can carry low-intensity fires that would have then, and would have in the past, thinned out the forest and the woodlands. And now that we don't have that grass anymore, the soil is more susceptible to erosion, while the woody vegetation then takes over the remainder of the land. But typically that woody vegetation is of such poor quality that we cannot harvest it, and we don't want to have fire in it, because then it might consume tens of thousands of acres at a time.
What do you do about that? I mean, there are conversations about thinning the forests, which isn't burning them, but actually cutting wood out. And then which trees do you cut out and which trees do you leave, and what is the economics of all of that versus burning? What are your thoughts on that?
I really think there needs to be a combined strategy, and that's what we're pursuing here in this project. So combining thinning, because thinning costs more than prescribed fire. So thin in the high priority areas and prioritize other areas for prescribed fire. And the treatments are most beneficial to the ecology and to the reducing wildfire risk when you combine them. So you want to thin. In this project, in the upper watershed, we're actually generating fuel wood for local communities, which is really important. So they're taking out the usable wood on their own time. And then we're going to come back and burn strategic areas to help recycle those nutrients and to reduce the risk.
We're talking to Eitan Krasilovsky and Jan Willem Janssens about the watershed and what's going on in this area in the Embuto Valley. And part of the reason we're talking is because, I mean, you've been out there, both of you and many others, talking to people in communities, learning what's going on the ground, learning what people are concerned about, what they want, and then talking to people. And this is a complicated issue, because when you're talking about the people who are in charge of various governments, you're talking across jurisdictions, because watersheds unfortunately don't correspond to governmental jurisdictions. And every time we have Jack Loeffler on the air, he talks about this wonderful map by John Wesley Powell that organized the states in the West according to watershed instead of making straight lines, and that would have been great, but we didn't get that. So what we basically have to do is come to agreements across communities and across jurisdictions of what to do, and then actually implement those things. And this is not an easy task.
Yeah, so this is a great time to mention that a lot of the implementation that we've been referencing in the Rio Trompas watershed, as we call it, is happening on New Mexico state land office land. So these are state trust lands, and we've had really great success working with the state land office for this restoration work. But we're also working with Picaris Pueblo, the Carson National Forest, and the Bureau of Land Management and New Mexico State Forestry, who manages forests on the private lands in this area. So we're having these conversations, and we're trying to coordinate where possible.
Yeah, basically what this entails and what you're asking is that our approach has been what we could call on a landscape scale. And a couple decades ago, Senator Bingaman in the late 1990s saw the need to start what is called now Collaborative Forest Restoration Program in New Mexico. And it started in 2000. And Eitan and I have been working on several projects, first in the Truchas area, Santa Cruz area, and now in this area, to look at a landscape scale how you can do watershed and forest restoration work across jurisdictions. To talk with people around the table how multiple jurisdictions do this work. Besides that, and that was by design, I've been involved also with watershed planning on a landscape scale with the Arid Land Institute at Woodbury University, with funding through the State Environment Department, actually coming from the EPA, and to make a watershed plan for the entire area, which is the same area that we're working in under this forestry program as well, so that we address the issues from, you could say, the watershed and water quality point of view, and also from the forest health point of view, and then share, you could say, compare notes and agendas, so that all the agencies talk with each other, and then at the same time bring the watershed restoration component into the forest health work that we're doing through the Forest Guild and the Collaborative Forest Restoration Program on state land.
Yeah, and so when we started this planning process with all these people in the room and community members as well, we identified priority areas on maps and identified priority issues for folks in those areas, and generated a computer map model regardless of land ownership. So we really tried to carry it through every step of the process that, like you said, jurisdictions are problematic and we need to be thinking across fence lines. So the maps of where we want to do thinning and burning and where planning is taking place, they cross areas. So while we're working on New Mexico State Trust lands now, we hope to move across the fence onto the BLM lands next door once the planning is done. And that's the case with Pickery's Pueblo and the Forest Service. And we hope to connect even private land treatments with Forest Service treatments as well.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that you are working on developing some really innovative ways to do landscape restoration work. What are some of the things you're doing?
Well, one of the things that I'm pioneering with Eitan and the Forest Guild is to look at the ecology of a place and where water flows so that we have a better understanding of how the hydrology or the water flow and water infiltration at a certain place influences the regeneration, the regrowth of certain plants. And certain areas are more prone to growing grass, other areas are more prone to growing shrubs like juniper and pinons or other shrubs. And certain areas are more prone to shed those trees or where they will die more quickly and others not. So understanding that based on the topography, where water flows, whether it's a north or south-facing slope, whether it's higher or lower up on the slope, makes a lot of difference in how you choose to use what kind of techniques. And one of the techniques that we are exploring right now is emulated after Vandalia National Monument's work of the last 10-15 years, where they have cut juniper trees and pinons and used the slash, the branches, to cover the soil and create a microclimate on the soil that holds the dirt back as it flows down. It also slows down the splash impact of raindrops, and it creates a microclimate in which grass can regrow. And so using that technique combined with mechanical soil erosion techniques, putting stones, logs, and other things on contour in very intricate little structures that are cumulatively repeated and designed for a specific area, you can actually gradually stimulate grass growth and soil accumulation at critical points. And so choosing those critical points where you can kickstart nature's healing is so important, where we're trying to really understand the natural dynamics of this, of a piece of land, to then work with the natural forces and healing power of nature, you could say, to heal that place. And that hope that from there, and that hope is grounded in experience, that actually that stretches beyond just the area where you treated it.
It's interesting because there really is an analogy to human health, which is that you treat like a little infected area and then the whole body becomes healthy. And it really is, I think it's so interesting and important that when you understand a piece of land, like what naturally grows there, what is the natural plant and animal ecology of that piece of land, and you just give it a chance to go back to what it wants to be, you take the first steps and nature does the rest.
Yeah, but there's a human component to that too that I'd like to add in terms of our innovation, and that is that at a community level, and Eitan can talk about that more in terms of what's happening statewide, we're trying to find ways to reach to local community members who actually eventually will need to be the stewards of a lot of this land, and to local contractors in a way that it's not a cutthroat competitive system like it often has been, because that leads to very poor quality on the land. We want actually to build capacity among local communities and contractors so that we actually offer them a contract that says, what can you do for this amount of money, and that we teach them to triage and prioritize in an area where they can make the biggest difference. And understanding the ecology of the place will then lead them to make the biggest difference and the smartest choices for land health improvements.
Yeah, like you said, we want to build capacity to do this at a larger scale. The scale we're doing it at right now is very small compared to the landscape. So we need to have methods that are cost-effective, methods that benefit local economies and workforces, and also do the right thing by the land. And so training is a really big part of this, and we've had one field training day recently this summer. We're having a second one, and I'm really excited about the learning that's happening there between farmers, landowners, and contractors about reading the landscape and thinking about how to engineer these solutions in a cost-effective way.
And it's truly collaborative in the sense that we, although we have bring some expertise, we also acknowledge that a lot of these people that we're inviting to the workshops have a lot of knowledge, experiential knowledge.
Because they live there.
Exactly. And they have worked for generations as contractors, as farmers. And we want to hear from them, how they see it, so that if we write a prescription or a request for proposals for land health improvements, that we understand how they see what they can do, or where they maybe perceive it differently, so that we can have a dialogue about, how can we all come to the same way of looking at it, or at least a similar way of looking at it and understanding it, so that we're starting more or less at the same point in a dialogue and in a procedural matter of giving out a contract for land restoration work.
One of the things that I think is inspiring is when you do a piece of land, when you do some land restoration work and then see the effects of it. And the effects of it can come pretty quickly. Sometimes we see these before and after pictures when somebody's done some riparian restoration, and it's like night and day. What are some of the things you've seen? Like you do a job and then you come back 3 weeks or 3 years later.
Yeah, I was recently on Glorieta Mesa, and the landowner was so excited. We did a monitoring there of a piece of land, also with the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, monitoring a conservation easement. And we saw that the ponds and wetlands that we had created were totally full of water. All the land that was barren 3 years ago was totally covered with grass and native wildflowers. And there were elk and deer prints all over the place, and we saw them in the land, on the land. And so land can rebound if you apply these techniques. And I'm sure that through the fire-adapted communities, after a thinning project and work, you have experienced this too, as to what people see on the land, Eitan.
Yeah, thank you, Jan-Willem. So we've been doing treatments by Glorieta for the past few years, and these treatments have been focused on reducing fire risk to a community that, you know, was ranked pretty high by Santa Fe County. And almost immediately after treatment of the by doing tree thinning of the small trees, we started seeing deer on site. And at the same time, standing there with a local volunteer firefighter, that firefighter also said, "Wow, I can see through the forest. I can see wildlife that I didn't see before, and I feel like I could defend a fire here. This is an important patch of ground for this community in terms of fighting a wildfire." We're going to go back and burn some piles of slash that we created, and I think that's going to be another opportunity to look back and say, okay, what is the condition now? Did everything we hoped for come to pass? Are there still needs on this patch of ground? And so those processes are really rewarding in this line of work.
One of the things that you guys are doing is teaching workshops on ecological restoration. One of them just happened this weekend, but there's more coming up. Who should take those?
Well, the workshops that we have worked on were tailored specifically to local residents who are interested in doing stewardship work on this kind of land, and also to contractors, as I mentioned earlier, whom we want to include in this new approach to contracting and land health that is smart rather than based on a cost per acre and how much you can get done per acre and how you minimize your price, because that doesn't really get the job done of health improvement. And definitely students, college students and their professors, any other professional that is really interested in innovation and change, because they understand that with the current approaches that we have pioneered, we're in certain ways stuck, and that we need to look at all these new things that we're collaboratively exploring.
Another interesting group in the trainings we've had have been firefighters. So a lot of times contractors themselves are firefighters. And then we've had firefighters on site, you know, dressed up in their yellows and greens with their packs on, learning about reading a landscape, watershed health, and erosion. And they're there to, you know, expand their knowledge and think about how, when they do fire risk mitigation, they can incorporate these techniques into the fire risk mitigation, because we want to, you know, we want to have these things working together wherever possible.
Another interesting thing to mention maybe is that this land, particularly where we're working right now on state trust land, is a grazing lease. And while past grazing has done a lot of damage on these lands, we believe also that there is actually a possibility to work with the lessees to come up with a managed approach to grazing. That means that when the grazing is done right, we can, through the grazing, a prescribed form of grazing with a lot of rest, that is, stimulate regeneration of grass and soil on these areas. And we've reached out to the permittee to ask him whether he is interested in this, and he definitely is, because he sees that the old ways are not helping him keep the cows on the land, because there's really nothing to eat.
Jan Willem Janssens is director of Ecotone Ecological Planning and Restoration. Eitan Krasilovsky is Southwest Region Director of the Forest Guild. If there's somebody listening who might want to get involved or take these workshops, whom should they get in touch with?
Well, we have a webpage for the project. It's forestguild.org/Rio Trompas Watershed, and you can navigate to it from the forestguild.org homepage. I think that's definitely one way. Contacting Jan Willem, especially if you're a private landowner that wants to do some of these things on their land, contacting Ecotone is a great step.
Yeah, I'm best contacted just directly through email and phone. And my email address is jwjanssens@gmail.com. And my phone number, I can easily give that, is 505-470-2531.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we'll have you back next time around.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.